And now for something completely different.
This is the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Let's do it.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. With you till 3 on this Friday as we kickstart the weekend with plenty to get to over the next few hours. Reaction from last night's NBA draft, plus we'll get to some winners and losers as well from last night. Some thoughts on Arch Manning and his commitment to Texas. The latest on Deshaun Watson and DeAndre Hopkins speaking out about his suspension. Major League Baseball power rankings coming up. Should the Braves boo, I should say Braves fans, boo Freddie Freeman this weekend? Get to that coming up. Plus, which divisions are the best in the NFL this year? What are the biggest storylines for the upcoming college football season? As we're about 70 days away. And a whole lot more throughout the afternoon. With you till 3, you can join the conversation throughout. 843-721-9500 to give us a call. You can always text the show. 843-608-1734. Get to us on Twitter at Morrow Middays. On Facebook at ESPN Charleston. Via email, studio@kirkmanbroadcasting.com, or online at charlestonsportsradio.com. Head over there and click on our show page, where you can leave a comment for the show. You can find the latest versions of the show podcasted right there, or take the Morrow Midday Show with you wherever you go. Just simply stream us online at charlestonsportsradio.com. With you till 3, as we start the weekend with plenty to do over the next few hours. Trent's on the steel wheels. Trent, what's going on? How are you?
Luke, I'm doing phenomenal on this beautiful Friday here in the Low Country. Great night of the NBA draft last night. A couple surprises here and there. Some obviously phenomenal suits, some interesting suits, and we'll kind of talk about those during Trent's takes. Got to get my opinions on those and whatever else comes up. Luke, it's a beautiful Friday. Glad to be here with you, kind sir.
Yeah, got a lot to get to. You know, so as I always say, I love my industry. I love this job. I love what I do. I love the sports industry. There's a lot I also dislike about it, too. And I was curious today. I flipped on a couple of radio shows this morning elsewhere, and all three that I checked in on opened the show with Kyrie Irving, and they're going to spend most of the day talking about Kyrie Irving. I watch Get Up. It's the only show I really watch, sports show I watch on TV. I watch it in the mornings as I get my day started. Same idea. Start of the show, talking about Kyrie Irving. Everyone's talking about Kyrie Irving. Nothing's going to happen for the next couple of days anyways. We can all sit here and wonder what's going to happen with Kyrie Irving. You can allow Kyrie to use you as a puppet to hold the Nets hostage. And everyone's going to talk about Kyrie Irving every day, all day long. And it's unbelievable. I can't stand it. I don't know why people fall in love with these storylines. I also don't know how you can even do a show where you talk about Kyrie Irving for all 2 hours. I would drive myself nuts. So today, we're not going to talk Kyrie Irving. We're going to open with the draft, which actually happened last night and I think is a little more exciting and pertinent than Kyrie Irving's latest debacle. And we're going to touch on about 15 different things today because that's how I always like to do it. I can't sit here and talk about the same thing over and over again for 3 hours. I'll drive myself nuts, let alone probably you as well. So hopefully you appreciate it. But we're going to talk about 15 different topics throughout the afternoon instead of sitting here twiddling our thumbs on Kyrie Irving for hours. And with that, let me start with the draft. Paolo Banchero goes first overall. I thought he was the best player in the draft. It was a surprise in the sense that the media led you to think it was a surprise. We all thought Jabari Smith was going to go first overall. Banchero goes first to the Magic. I thought it was the right move. I think he's the best player in the draft. I think he's the most ready to go. I think Banchero could have the largest impact, at least of the top three, in the NBA this year. Holmgren's a project. I think Jabari Smith still needs to grow. But I think Paolo Banchero can have success right away. Will he be an immediate star? Not necessarily, but he can have an impact this year. He's not going to be a guy that looks overmatched out there that you think, maybe like a Chet Holmgren. Right, we kind of got to get him off the floor right now. We got to wait till he grows. That's not the case with Banchero. Right? He's 6'10". He's athletic. He's long. He gets up and down the floor. Solid on defense. Right? Good enough. He can score it. Played at Duke. It's not like he's coming from a Gonzaga or a mid-major. Big fan of Banchero. I thought he was the best player in this draft, and I think he's the safest pick as well. Is he going to be like a five-time All-Star, a Hall of Famer? I don't know, but I don't think he's going to be somebody who's quickly out of the league or he's the eighth man. He may not be the star of the Magic 5 years from now, but I think at minimum, right, he's still a starter for you that does a good job. Is he going to average 25 points a game? I think he could. I'm not going to guarantee it, but I think his floor is very high. He's not going to bottom out, and it's not going to be an Anthony Bennett situation where 3 years from now he's out of the league. I think if nothing else, Banchero will be at least a good sidekick. He'll be a good two or three on a team. Maybe like what Andrew Wiggins became, where Wiggins was looking like a bust when he was supposed to be the star, put him on a team where he doesn't have to be the star, and he shows how good he can be in the NBA. I think that's worst-case scenario for Banchero. Maybe he's not the star, but he's a really good number two. I think he'll be fine. Holmgren, I think a little more of a project. Jabari Smith has a high ceiling, but I still think there's some room to grow. But Banchero goes first. Holmgren, 2. Jabari Smith, 3. Keegan Murray, 4. Jaden Ivey, 5. We'll come back to that in just a moment. Here was Woj this morning on Get Up talking about Banchero going first and how seemed to be a surprise. Maybe because some people got taken. Banchero is the best player in the draft. He goes number 1. Here was Woj's reaction this morning.
It was a lot of surprise. It was about 7:30, 7:25 when we started to get a sense that indeed the pick was going to be Banchero. And this was one of the great stealth free draft operations run by Jeff Weltman, John Hammond in Orlando. They had everybody convinced that Jabari Smith Jr. was going to be their pick at number one. Jabari Smith Jr.'s camp believed they were going number one. Chet Holmgren and his camp, they believed they were at number two to Oklahoma City, which is how that stood up. And of course, the Rockets went from believing they were going to take Banchero to, in that time frame, realizing that there was a really good chance that Jabari Smith Jr., the player that many thought was going to be number one overall, would make it to them at number 3.
That was Woj this morning. You know, if I'm being honest, I think it's a little damage control because Woj actually got it wrong. He was reporting that it was going to be Jabari Smith, even when the odds changed, even when Vegas knew something was up. Vegas made Banchero the favorite, and still Woj said, no, Jabari Smith's going number one to Orlando. Paolo's going to go third to the Rockets. And then minutes before the draft, he switched his opinion and said, oh, actually, Banchero is going to go to Orlando. Something seems off about all this, not even with the whole Woj theory. But Orlando never brought in Banchero for some sort of tryout or anything. And according to reports, Banchero didn't really care to go to Orlando. So maybe that's why the Magic didn't even bother trying to do things with him pre-draft, because they knew he wouldn't be interested. But as Woj said in that clip, right, the Magic did a great job keeping it under wraps. Why? They're the number one pick. Doesn't matter. When it comes to the NFL draft, we know months in advance who the teams are taking. It makes no sense for Orlando to try to keep this under wraps and not work out Banchero and show no interest just to take him number one. So either Woj is trying to save himself by coming up with some Fugazi storyline of Orlando had, though they did a great job of keeping it a secret. Why do they have to keep it a secret? They're picking first. No one can jump in front of them. You want to tell me because it's going to make things a little bit harder on the teams after them? Okay. Then Houston has 20 minutes to make their decision, and they realize, okay, Banchero's off the board. All right, we'll go with Jabari Smith. There you go. Decision made. And Chet Holmgren's going too? All right, well, we like Jabari Smith next. We'll take him 3. Makes no sense for Orlando to try to keep this such a secret. So something's off. Either the Magic were unable to get things done with Banchero before the draft because he was uninterested, which wouldn't be a great sign, or maybe Woj is just trying to save himself because he was wrong the whole time. I don't know. But it seems odd that the team picking first overall would supposedly try to keep this whole thing a secret. Makes no sense. You're picking first. Who cares? No one can do anything about it. You could take whoever you want. You could have drafted Trent if you want, and no one's going to do anything about it. You don't need to keep it a secret. With that said, the big surprise maybe was Banchero going first overall. And then people were surprised Keegan Murray went 4th, Jaden Ivey went 5th. Ivey didn't want to go play in Sacramento, so he winds up in Detroit. Here's what I find interesting. When we look at the draft last night, we focused so much on the big 3. Banchero, Holmgren, Jabari Smith. All one and dones. Then you get to Keegan Murray, who's a little bit older. Jaden Ivey's a little bit older. They went 4 and 5 in the draft. You go back and you look. Last 15 years. Now, I excluded last year because it's too soon. But if you go back last 15 years and look at the lottery, which is the top 14 picks of these drafts, there have been 89 one-and-dones drafted in the lottery. 89 players who spent 1 year in college and then went to the NBA. Of those 89 in the last 15 years, 14 have been All-Stars. So less than, 20%. Not a great rate. I'm not counting last year because it's too soon, but last year, 7 of the 14 players were one and done. None of them made an All-Star game as a rookie, which may be asking too much. But the percentage has gone down in recent years. It's gone even lower. Last 5 years, it's about 15% of one and dones taking in the lottery, top 14 players in the draft, actually become All-Stars. About 15%. Not great. The number one pick 13 straight years has been a one-and-done player. You have to go back to 2009 when Blake Griffin was the last guy to go number one who spent more than 1 year in college. We had six more last night in the lottery. Six out of the top 14 players last night were one-and-dones. This, of course, excludes international players. And the top three guys, again, last night were one-and-done. Banchero, Holmgren, Jabari Smith. Then you get to Keegan Murray, Jaden Ivey, who's a little more experienced. I wouldn't be surprised if we look back on this draft and maybe Murray and Ivey are the better players out of the top five. Holmgren's more of a project. Jabari Smith still needs to grow. I like Banchero. He is 19, though. Keegan Murray's 22. Right, Jaden Ivey spent a couple years in the league, played in March Madness, played in some big games, athletic guard, a little more mature. You know, the great thing about the Golden State Warriors, we talk about how they've built this team through the draft, and they did. But go back and look. Steph Curry spent 3 years in college. Klay Thompson spent 3 years. Draymond Green spent all 4 years at Michigan State. They're not built through one-and-dones. Not only did they use the draft, but they got guys who a little more experience in college. We're not 19-year-olds coming in and having to be stars right away. They got more experienced players who were a little more advanced coming into the league and turned into great players. Go back a couple years ago. Zion Williamson went number one, the best player in that draft. John Morant spent 2 years in college. Zion was a one-and-done. Donovan Mitchell spent multiple years in college. So, too, did Kawhi Leonard, James Harden, Paul George, Damian Lillard, Russell Westbrook, Chris Paul. Some of the better players in the league still today. Anthony Bennett was a huge bust as a one-and-done player being drafted first overall. Right after him was Victor Oladipo, who spent 3 years at Indiana. He was the much better player. I was talking about this yesterday where in the NBA draft, you got to give it a couple years. It's like buying a car, especially nowadays. I know that because of the chip shortage, right? Cars are being delivered to people's homes. You don't even get to see them at the lot. I don't know if the car industry has caught up. I know it was like that for a while. So you may buy a car. You got to wait till it gets delivered. Probably frustrating. You want that. You want to drive that car off the lot. They tell you, sorry, we got to send it to you from the factory. Hopefully it gets to you in a month. Like, a month? I need this car. I just bought the car. I want the car now. You don't want to wait around. You hear about a new movie coming out, and then they tell you, yes, wait till summer of 2027. What? Movie sounds great. I don't want to wait 5 years to watch it. In the NFL, these guys have to wait 3 years after high school. They're more developed. And they come in and they have immediate success. Quarterbacks, wide receivers, defensive backs, linemen, whoever it is, you plug them in, they start right away. They could be a Pro Bowler that first year. In the NBA, you got 19-year-olds that are 1 year removed from high school. Think about yourself. 12 months, less than 12 months from your, from your high school career ending. Were you ready to go? Even not even physically or athletically, but even just mentally. Like, were you mature enough to go play in the NBA and be given $1 million and have a team put on your back? If you go back and you look, a lot of the one-and-dones don't really have a high hit rate in the last 15 years. And some of the best players in the league, yes, of course, LeBron came out of high school, right? Kobe came out of high school. Those are all-time greats. Some of the best players in the league right now spent multiple years in college. All the guys on the Warriors, John Morant, Donovan Mitchell, Kawhi, James Harden, right? Paul George, Dame, Russ, Chris Paul. Plenty of guys that needed a little more maturing, took advantage of an extra year, then went to the NBA, became really good players. So when I look at last night's draft, the top three players all one and done. And then you get to Keegan Murray at number four, 22 years old, was the number one offensive rated player this past year in college basketball. Jaden Ivey, really good at number five, I think fits well with Detroit. Maybe those are actually the two best players out of the top five. More experience in college, a little bit older, more mature, even physically. Holmgren still a project. Jabari Smith, Banchero have room to grow. Those other guys, they've been around. Maybe they'll be able to have a larger impact right away. Let me shift to this. Arch Manning announced yesterday that he's going to Texas. Now, I said a couple weeks ago on the show, I would choose Georgia. Because I think for Georgia, you have the defense on the other side of the football. They just won a national championship with Stetson Bennett, and there's no other sort of obstacle in the quarterback room. Alabama's always bringing quarterback talent. And for Texas, not only do they have Quinn Ewers already there, Steve Sarkisian's probably the worst of those three head coaches, And it's also, it's still Texas. They're the worst program out of those three. And when you come into the SEC, it's going to be even harder to win than it would be at Alabama or Georgia. Texas was third on my list. I'd probably take Georgia over Alabama just because there would be no competition. They just won a national championship, did so with the defense. Like Kirby Smart will have that defense ready for you. Makes your job easier as a quarterback. And if they can win with Stetson Bennett, imagine what you could do there. I probably would pick Georgia. But I would like Georgia or Alabama more than Texas. Let's look at Arch Manning, his potential outline at Texas. He gets there next year. Maybe he redshirts. Quinn Ewers just redshirt, and it could work out that if Quinn Ewers is really good this year, well, after next season, he could go to the NFL. So it could time out perfectly for Texas. And just redshirt Arch Manning for a year. Quinn Ewers plays next year, goes to the NFL. Then Arch takes over as a redshirt freshman in 2024. He plays in 2024. They're in the Big Ten. Big 12. Then they go to the SEC in 2025. Third year for Arch Manning and the final year, potentially, of his college career. He could then jump to the NFL at that point. 2025, first year in the SEC. This is my concern, that if Arch Manning is as good as advertised, say he plays his freshman year, true freshman year, 2023, he plays 2 years at Texas, and we see like, oh yeah, this guy is really good. And we're talking about him in the draft that will be coming up less than a year from then when they join the SEC. My concern is he's going in there with a Big 12 roster against the SEC. How has Oklahoma, with a lot of Heisman quarterbacks, looked against SEC teams in the playoffs in recent years? And this will be right before he gets ready to go to the NFL. We would be talking at this time about Arch Manning in the upcoming draft. Now, he could be like Trevor Lawrence, where Trevor Lawrence was the first overall pick from the moment he came out of high school, and he ended up being, 3 years later, the first overall pick. Nothing changed. But we've seen the stock of quarterbacks drop in their final year. Happened to Tua. We thought he was the number one quarterback. He was not. Justin Herbert, remember, sucked for the Duck? He was not even the second quarterback taken. In hindsight, probably should have been. But Justin Herbert, his stock dropped at the end of his Oregon career. Even Justin Fields. We thought Justin Fields would be the guy. He was not the first quarterback taken. He was not the second quarterback taken. Even Deshaun Watson, right? Mitch Trubisky jumped up ahead of Deshaun Watson that final year. Trubisky's only year as a starter. People were concerned about Deshaun. He's turns the football over too much. And another Steve Sarkisian quarterback, Matt Leinart, who was the guy. Then you lose to Vince Young that final year, and Leinart drops to, he was picked, I think, 11th, somewhere around there. Vince Young went ahead of him. We've seen quarterbacks that had great careers, but in that final season, their stock drops a little bit. It'd be a little bit of a concern for me for Arch Manning and his future. And I know this is a storyline for 3 years from now, but when we talk about Arch and that end game, this is the end game. Texas joining the SEC in 2025 and probably not being prepared. Here is Pete Thamel this morning on Get Up talking about if he thought, he was answering a question of if he thought, you know, this means Texas is back, that they're ready to compete with the big dogs now that Arch Manning will be eventually going there.
They have so far to go that they are so beyond one recruit helping them get into that conversation. I mean, they need to be a bowl this year. Like, they went 5-7. They lost to Kansas at home. The best way to think about the state of this Texas program now, in the moment that Arch Manning has committed, is that they're essentially three touchdowns behind Arkansas, which is a middle-of-the-pack team in the SEC. They lost at Arkansas by essentially three touchdowns last year. So what Arch Manning does is gives them a building block for SEC competitiveness. He gives them a linchpin, a face of their recruiting, a magnet for other blue chips that can help them build and be competitive in the SEC. But to say Arch Manning, you know, they roll out of bed and can compete with Alabama and Georgia now is crazy. They have a long way to go. This is certainly a huge help, and you can't overstate what a big deal this is. But before we all yell Texas is back, let's wait a few years, stack a few recruiting classes, and really fill that roster with more talent.
Now, look, they do have three more years to prepare. When you get an Arch Manning, if Quinn Ewers plays well this year, that helps. You're going to get better recruits. Sarkisian's done a good job recruiting there. But as Thamel laid it out, right now, you're about three touchdowns behind Arkansas. Imagine what you would look like. In fact, we'll find out this season, right, how they stack up against an Alabama. That would be my concern for Arch Manning, that the year he's getting ready to potentially go to the NFL, here they come into the SEC, and they'll be behind the eight ball against every team they go up against. Because there's a difference between recruiting Big 12 talent and SEC talent. Go back and look at the programs that have joined the SEC in the last 30 years. The Gamecocks and Arkansas joined the SEC in 1992. South Carolina had Steve Tannehill. And their first winning record was not until their ninth year in the SEC. Pocket quarterback. Arkansas had a pocket quarterback. They went from six wins, joined the SEC, won three games their first year. They did not have a winning season until their fourth year in the SEC. More recently, a decade ago, we had Missouri and Texas A&M. Both came into the SEC. They both came from the same conference. They both had experienced offensive head coaches. One team got better their first year in the SEC. The other got worse. Missouri went from 8 wins to 5. They went 2-6 their first year in the SEC. Texas A&M went from 7 wins to then 11 in the SEC. They went 6-2 that first year in the conference. What was the difference? Johnny Manziel. Missouri had a pocket passer, just like Arkansas and USC 20 years earlier. Texas A&M had Johnny Manziel, who was their leading rusher that year, not only in yards but attempts. He ran it 16 times a game. Against Alabama, he ran it 18 times. Against Oklahoma that year, he ran it 17 times. He was running all over the place because a lot of times the offensive line isn't good enough. South Carolina came in as an independent into the SEC. They said, we're ready to compete. No, they weren't. And Steve Tannehill, pocket passer, he had negative rushing yards that year. That was quite an issue. Arkansas, pocket quarterback, negative rushing yards, couldn't escape. Quite an issue. They couldn't compete until their fourth year against the SEC. Missouri came in right away. Yeah, they took a big step back. Texas A&M somehow took a step forward. Why? Because they had the most athletic of those quarterbacks, Johnny Manziel. And once Manziel left, Texas A&M did not have another winning season in the SEC until they got Kellen Mond, athletic quarterback. Now, when it comes to Arch Manning, he is more Archie Manning than he is Peyton Manning. He is more athletic and mobile than Peyton or even Eli. But, and I don't know how much we can glean off the high school stats, he averages to run the football 3 times a game in high school. So it's not like he's running all over the field. Yes, he is mobile. He's athletic. He can keep some plays alive. I don't think he's a Johnny Manziel, who led the team in rushing yards, had almost twice as many rushing yards as any running back. He was the star in the passing game and the running game. I don't think that's Arch Manning. And when Texas joins the SEC, I think they'll be at a disadvantage in the trenches, just like those other teams were. And the only team that could handle it well, Texas A&M, was because they had a quarterback that could just take off and run. He could get away from that pressure. He can make up for the deficiencies on the offensive line. I don't know if Arch will be able to do that 3 years from now. Get back to me in 2025. But it's my concern for Arch Manning that once they join the SEC, that's going to be the big year. That's the year that he could potentially come out of college. Maybe he would be the number one pick. And he's going to be joining the SEC right at that time at quite a disadvantage. And I don't know if he has the mobility of a Johnny Manziel to be able to make plays with his legs when he potentially has to run for his life against some of these pass rushes of the SEC a few years from now. When we come back, the latest on Deshaun Watson, plus DeAndre Hopkins spoke out for the first time about his suspension this year. We'll get to some of the issues a couple of former Clemson Tigers are facing right now. It's the Morrow Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
Now back to the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Coming up, the latest on a couple of former Clemson Tigers. DeAndre Hopkins speaks for the first time since his suspension in the NFL. And the latest on Deshaun Watson, because every day there always seems to be something new with this whole story. We'll get to that here on the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow on ESPN Radio. First, let's touch on DeAndre Hopkins, who was suspended by the NFL this past offseason. He'll have to miss the first 6 games of the upcoming season. Now, he talked to the media this past week, a couple days ago, for the first time since that suspension. Here's what Hopkins had to say. A couple of things stand out that are of interest. This was Hopkins' response when asked about his PED suspension the other day.
I've been good. I've been good. Recovering, healing. Unfortunately, you know, I got to miss 6 games. But, you know, it is what it is. But, you know, the team will be ready, and I'll be ready when I'm up. You know, we're still, doing some research right now. So hopefully, you know, before the season starts, you know, maybe we can get the games down a little bit. But, no, that wasn't on me. I'm a natural, pretty much a naturopathic kind of person, man. And what it was called Osterin. And it was 0.1% of it found in my system, which is, if you know what that is, you know, it's contamination, not something directly taken. I don't take any supplements. I've never taken supplements. I barely take vitamins. You know, so for something like that to happen, to me, obviously, you know, I was shocked. But you know, my team and I, we're still, you know, trying to, you know, figure out what's going on. I'm a competitor, so you know, anytime I'm not on the field, you know, for me, it's frustrating. That's the NFL, next man up. So I have no doubt in those guys that, you know, to win those six games until I'm ready. I'll be ready by training camp.
That was DeAndre Hopkins this week. By the way, he did drop his appeal. He never did actually appeal. So I don't know if that's an admission of guilt, but if you truly felt like you were innocent, wouldn't you want your chance to fight for that suspension or try to get it knocked down? He did not appeal it this offseason, so he is going to get six games with the NFL. He's not fighting it. Kind of seems like if I did something that I didn't actually do and you accuse me of it and you're going to punish me, I think I would fight to try to clear my name or get some of those games back or paychecks as well. Maybe just me, but when I saw that DeAndre wasn't appealing, to me that's almost an admission of guilt. I'm waiting for the athlete that gets caught for something that just sits up there and owns it for once. And the only one that I can recall was Andy Pettit actually did a press conference and he apologized. And he said, yeah, I did it. I shouldn't have. And you know what? Nobody remembers that. When you talk about baseball players who got caught doing things, you'll mention Barry Bonds and McGuire and this guy and that guy. I don't think anybody remembers that Andy Pettit got caught and suspended for steroids. Because he actually sat there and he owned it. He didn't make up some excuse like, I don't know how this got in my system. Like Gary Sheffield, right? Remember said it was it was a cream they were rubbing on my knee. I didn't know what was in it. Yeah, that's how the steroids wound up in your system. They were rubbing a cream on your knee. And oh, just look at that. Now he's all juiced up. It's in his blood. Right? We hear these ridiculous stories. Now for DeAndre Hopkins, I don't know. 0.01, whatever he said, 0.1. Maybe that's the case. I don't know. We don't have that information. As he said, it's contamination. But the most interesting part is it's twofold. Number one, it's the same supplement or thing that a couple of Clemson players got caught with going back, what was that, 3 years ago now? Osterin, and of course, DeAndre Hopkins, right, coming from Clemson. So that's an interesting coincidence. And so, too, is kind of the excuse where he said it's contamination, which we also heard at the time about the Clemson players. And people were saying, right, oh, the Clemson guy, oh, no, it must have been in the cereal that they had. Go to the store and you can see Osterin is, right, which I don't think is the case. I don't think it's in day-to-day things that you consume in your body. But it's the same substance, and it's the same kind of excuse-making of just contamination. And maybe it is, but if it truly is, I would think that DeAndre Hopkins would want to fight it. If you look up Osterin, from what I see, it's all like pill form. So I think it's something that you actually do have to take. You have to ingest in order to get that in your system. Now, I'm not smart enough to know other ways of it getting into your body. But I do find it interesting that it's the same thing as his alma mater ran into a couple years ago. And it's kind of the same playbook of writing it off or playing it off. However, for Hopkins, not appealing the suspension. Maybe he doesn't think it's worth the battle, but I certainly would want to fight it if I truly thought I was innocent and didn't do anything wrong. And I'm still waiting, like I said, for that guy to get up there and just own it. So, yep, I took something that I shouldn't have. My bad. I'll come back after the six games better than ever, and I'll show you that I don't need this stuff. Something along those lines. Right? Accept the responsibility if you're going to do something wrong. It happens a lot more in baseball, but the amount of excuses we get. Alex Rodriguez got busted twice, right? Like, never admitted to it. He sued Major League Baseball. Oh, yeah, that was Major League Baseball. You're right. They screwed up. It wasn't you, Alex, that took something that you shouldn't have. I accept responsibility. Maybe by not appealing, DeAndre is doing that, at least in his actions, but not with the words of the media. Hey, that was DeAndre Hopkins. Deshaun Watson, of course, is the other Clemson Tiger who we're waiting to see what is going to happen. We know about Hopkins. He's suspended for six games. He's not appealing it. That's it. We'll see you in October. Deshaun Watson, we have no idea what's going to happen. This was Amy Dash on CBS Sports Radio. She's a legal analyst. You'll hear her all over. She works for Fox. She works for CBS. You'll hear her all over the place. Here was Amy Dash, her opinion on a potential punishment for Deshaun Watson with the NFL. We're still waiting to see what the NFL is going to do. Here is Amy Dash, who is a lawyer, her legal analysis, her two cents on what we could see for a punishment for Deshaun.
It's going to have to be done on a case-by-case basis and then go to the minimum of six games and you know, multiply that. Of course, it could be more than six games per person, depending on the seriousness of the allegation and whether there's enough evidence to support that it happened or not. But I think it's going to be minimum six times however many the evidence supports.
Amy Dash. So to clarify, she thinks it's going to be a case-by-case basis, six-game suspension, not overall, but per case. So do that math. Six games per case, 24 cases. That's 144 games. Now, I hear Amy Dash a lot. She's not somebody who's out of touch or some sort of hot take. She's really good at what she does. So when I heard this audio, I was shocked to think that anybody would think that Deshaun Watson would get a suspension of 144 games. Divide that by 17 games a year, that's 8.5 seasons. You might as well just kick him out of the league. I would put it, as I always say, nothing or very few things in life are 0% or 100% chance. This I would put at about a 0% chance that Deshaun is going to be suspended for 8.5 years. It's not going to happen. I thought it was a pretty outlandish thing for Amy to even suggest. But with that said, I do think she makes a fair point, even if it's not the point she's trying to make, in the sense that what's the difference? Why do we look at one case and 24 cases the same? If another player had the same thing happen and it was only one incident, would he get the same suspension as Deshaun Watson? Are we saying, hey, you went six games? Or even if Deshaun suspended for a year, right? If somebody else had a similar incident and it was four cases, we say, oh, yeah, four, that should be a year. Like, at what point does it all just blend together? There are 24, or at least were before all the settlements, right? 24 lawsuits and accusations, and a couple of others who haven't quite come forward yet. But, you know, we've had 26 women that actually have spoken to lawyers and have spoken out. I do get the point that maybe Amy's trying to make, in the sense that for those suggesting, like, yeah, six games, that's what it is, right? That's what Ezekiel Elliott got and everything. But that kind of means that it's the same between one incident and, in this case, you know, like 26. And it's just like, you know, if you were to commit multiple crimes, you would have multiple punishments. They don't necessarily bunch it all together when you go into court. Right? They find if you were guilty on this count and this count and this count. Why, when it comes to this case, are we looking at 24 incidents as essentially just one big thing? Dan Wetzel also had this article for Yahoo Sports. And, you know, 20 of the 24 women have settled with Deshaun Watson. Four have not. One of them is Ashley Solis, who was the first woman to put a face and a name to the accusation. She was the first woman to come out publicly. She was has also been probably the most outspoken of the accusers. She's really probably the only one that you may even know the name of. She's been in the forefront of all this. And she has not settled. She was the first one to really bring this up. And so maybe you thought at the time, like, right, money grab. Well, she hasn't settled yet. And in this article, it is interesting, the breakdown that Dan Wetzel gives, that, as he says, it was Solis who had an established professional massage therapy business. It was Solis who was contacted out of the blue by Deshaun Watson via Instagram. It was Solis who describes a creepy run-up to the meeting, alleging Watson inquired if she would be alone before sprawling out naked on the massage table with just a small hand towel. And I won't read the rest of the sentence. It is Solis who testified she ended the meeting abruptly and cried in front of Watson, which Watson acknowledged under oath, describing Solis as teary-eyed. Remember, he did send an apology text, although acknowledged no wrongdoing. And then also, this was another text message from Deshaun to Solis that we know, that they have the evidence of. Deshaun texted her and said, I know you have a career and a reputation, and I know you would hate for someone to mess with yours, just like I don't want anyone messing with mine. Is that somebody on the defensive, afraid that she's going to spread rumors about him, or is that somebody sending a threat to a massage therapist? I know you have a career and a reputation, and I know you would hate for someone to mess with yours, just like I don't want anyone messing with mine. It's always hard to get tone of a written message, so I don't know. Is he saying it like I kind of just said it with a threatening tone, or is he saying it like a little more cheery, you know, like, don't be spreading any rumors about me. I didn't do anything wrong. But he did send a message of apology. He sent that message as well that, I don't know, maybe you interpret as a threat or not. And Ashley Solis, I'm sure, has been offered the same amount of money as everyone else and has not settled yet, because maybe her attorney, Tony Busby, believes she has the strongest case to get even more out of Deshaun. That could be the troubling part in all this, that while Deshaun has settled 20 of 24, it doesn't mean it's gone away. There are still other cases out there, and maybe this is the linchpin. This is the big one. Ashley Solis, who was kind of the first one to start all of this, and maybe has the most evidence, most damning evidence against Deshaun Watson. I was not aware of this text message prior to reading this story from Dan Wetzel yesterday. And to me, again, you never know tone from text, whether it's an email, a text message, whatever. You don't really know. You interpret it your own way. I interpret it as almost like some sort of threat. I interpret it as not looking great for Deshaun. I think it looks worse than it does good for Deshaun in this case. Maybe that's just me. But that's the one that the attorney, Tony Busby, said that she's the big name in all this. She's the one that's kind of keeping this all together. Deshaun probably wishes she would settle, but I think she's looking for even more. She's not just going to take the money and be quiet. She really wants to make sure that something happens. And it goes back to what I said about we played that audio a couple weeks ago where Deshaun said, right, I've never, whatever his words were, harassed or offended a woman or anything. But that's a two-way street. And for him to send a text message to Solis afterwards because she was crying must have been an acknowledgement that she was upset about something, even if it wasn't your intention. Which is why I said at the time, it's hard for somebody to sit up there and say, like, I've never upset a woman before. I've never offended a woman. Well, I mean, that's not really for you to decide. You may feel like you've never done anything that would offend or harass a woman, but she may have taken it differently. And in this case, she was crying, and he sent a text message to apologize. You must have been apologizing for something. But with all that said, in regards to Amy Dash's suggestion, I don't think that will be the outcome for Deshaun in the NFL. I don't think he's going to get an 8.5-year suspension. But we'll still wait and see. When we come back, it's been a few weeks. We'll get to our Major League Baseball power rankings now that we're almost midway through the season. The Morrow Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
Now back to the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio. Let me tell you.
Coming up, power rankings for Major League Baseball here on the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow on ESPN Radio. And I complained about this yesterday, but I think it's a great weekend of baseball. And this is a perfect opportunity. Like, I know the Stanley Cup Finals is going on tonight. It may wrap up tonight. The NBA, they're done with. They just had their draft. Now that's why everyone's talking about Kyrie Irving today, right? Because that's all that's going on in the NBA. If I'm Major League Baseball, especially now, this feels like the first weekend with not a whole lot going on this summer, I would take advantage and call this like, I don't know, come up with some clever name. Major League Baseball is just some idea of taking over the weekend, or the summer's here. Play that up. Because we got some interesting series. You have the Braves-Dodgers, of course. That's on your radar starting tonight. That should be interesting. Freddie Freeman's return to Atlanta. More on that in just a moment. You have Yankees-Astros, which was a wild game last night. That's a four-game series that will continue. You even have, and I know it's early, too early to be looking at the standings, but you have the Red Sox and Cleveland, two teams that right now are battling for wild cards, but they have two of the five best records in the AL. You also even have, like, Phillies, Padres, intriguing. Two teams with winning records in the playoff race. You got the Brewers and the Blue Jays, two playoff teams with the season ended right now. It's just a coincidence, but there happens to be this weekend where there's not a lot else going on. Like, there's some good baseball series if you're into baseball. You wouldn't know because you don't hear a word from Major League Baseball. But I think it's a golden opportunity. Promote the heck out of it. There's nothing else going on. Stanley Cup's tonight, but baseball, we see the numbers. They're still more popular than hockey. You're not competing with that audience. Promote your game. Pump it up. The summer is supposed to belong to baseball. Starting this weekend. Power rankings. We did this around Memorial Day. Because the idea was, right, you don't look at the standings until Memorial Day. So when we came back on the air after Memorial Day weekend, I gave you my rankings at the time. The only power rankings we had done up to that point. So here's our second version of power rankings this year in Major League Baseball. Because some teams have really turned it on here in June. Number one with a bullet is the Yankees. There's no one even close right now. And it pains me to say as a Red Sox fan, but I have to admit it. The last thing I was holding on to was, yeah, but they haven't done great against teams with winning records. Which was true. But now they've played 10 straight games against teams with winning records. I said these 2 weeks are going to be a real test, and so far they've gone 8-2 against those teams. They're just beating everybody. They're on pace to set the record for most wins in a season. Aaron Judge is on pace to set a record for most homers for a Yankee ever. There's nothing more I could say. The Yankees are 16-6 in one-run games. They're 23-9 now against teams with a winning record. They're number one in runs scored. They have allowed the fewest runs. They have the most comeback wins. They have the best record at home, the best record on the road. They're number one in everything. And if you follow the Yankees at all, it just seems like they're a team of destiny right now. These last two nights specifically. They were down 4-1 on the road against Tampa, came back to win. I think it was the eighth inning. They won 5-4. Last night, down 6-3 against the Astros, the second-best team in the AL. They score four runs in the bottom of the ninth. And it's Aaron Hicks who hits the tying home run. It was Jose Trevino the night before who gets the winning hit. It's Clay Holmes, who is their star closer now with a .3 earned run average. It's a bunch of guys that you've never heard of. And it's classic. This is what the Yankees would always do when they were winning World Series. They'd bring in everybody, and they'd throw on the pinstripes, and they would have career years. And as a Red Sox fan, it has always frustrated me to no end. But they'll grab somebody off the waiver wire. He comes in and clobbers 20 homers. Like, what the heck? Where has this guy been? It's like Chaz Palminteri would say in The Bronx Tale, you know why the Yankees always win? Because everyone's distracted by their pinstripes. And it's those same pinstripes that give the power to these guys when they put that uniform on, evidently. Right now, the Yankees are cruising. They're number one. I would say there's a huge gap right now between them and everybody else. Now, the great thing about baseball, we've seen a lot of wild card teams win the World Series. We've seen the Dodgers with the best record not actually win. So it's such a long season that things could change by the time you get to October. They just have to be playing their best baseball in October. But right now, the Yankees clearly are the best team in baseball. I don't think it's all that close. Number two, I would say the Mets are the second best team in baseball, especially what they're doing without Scherzer and DeGrom. Wildly impressive. Number three, I would put the Dodgers. Now, Walker Buehler, I believe, may be out for the year or at least come back at the very end of the season. They're also missing their best reliever, and now Mookie Betts is injured for a while. So I'm curious to see how the Dodgers will see him up close and personal this weekend against the Braves, but I am curious to see how things go these next few weeks. They're a little banged up right now. Number four, I put the Astros. So that makes them the second-best team in the AL. And number five, I would say the Padres. What the Padres are doing, they're hanging right with the Dodgers. They've been even with the Dodgers all year. And they've been doing it without Fernando Tatis Jr. Now, Machado got hurt this week, so that's a concern for the Padres. If Machado's out for a while because he was having like an MVP type of season, that could hurt for the Padres. But I put them at number five right now. Those are the five best teams in baseball. Yankees, Mets, Dodgers, Astros, Padres, in that order. The other categories, teams that are hot right now. Baseball is such a long season that sometimes you can ignore a bad April. The Braves right now are 18-3 in June. And I'd probably put them number six if I continued my top list of teams. The Braves may be the sixth best team in baseball right now. They're playing like one of the best teams in baseball, 18-3 in June. The Red Sox are 16-4 in the month of June. The Cleveland Guardians, 16-4 in the month of June. By the way, the Guardians have one of the five lowest payrolls in baseball. They're in first place right now. So they've been quite the surprise and pretty impressive this year. But those are the three best records this month behind the Yankees in baseball. The Braves, Red Sox, Guardians. Those are the three hottest teams over the past month along with the Yankees. And they're teams that are playing better and have taken over playoff spots right now. So they're getting hot maybe at the right time. We'll see if they can keep this up the rest of the season. But they're teams that because of slow starts, you don't really think about them as the best teams in the league. They've been playing like it for the past month. And usually it's the June swoon, right, where teams fall apart. Usually the Red Sox have a June swoon. Well, the teams that are fading this June, the Rays, the Twins, and the Brewers are all under 500 in their last 30 games after hot starts. All three teams dealing with injuries, but they're struggling right now. The Rays, the Twins, the Brewers. And the Rays have not won back-to-back games in over 2 weeks. And then the last category I'll give you, most disappointing. And that's still the White Sox, the Angels, Seattle, and the Phillies. The White Sox are still under 500. A lot of people thought they could potentially win the AL this year. The Angels, after that great start, we know they fired Joe Maddon. They're still under 500, probably won't be competing in September. Seattle won more games than the Braves last year, and yet they're seven games under 500 and are in third place in a bad division. And the Phillies, they are over 500, but they still haven't been consistent enough. Right, the Phillies have high hopes. They fired their manager already this year. They're just at this point kind of treading water, just playing 500 baseball. They have a better roster than that. They should be more competitive in the NL. So those are my five top teams in baseball, plus the teams that are playing the best right now, the teams that are playing the worst, and the teams that are most disappointing. We get Braves-Dodgers this weekend. Should be really interesting. When we come back, do you boo Freddie Freeman tonight when he returns to Atlanta? It's the Mara Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Attention campers, lunch has been canceled today due to lack of hustle. deal with it.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
Wrapping up hour one of the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. Freddie Freeman makes his big return to Atlanta tonight. Do you boo Freddie Freeman? Jeff Schultz, who covers Atlanta sports for The Athletic, put out a poll and asked the same question. 64% of voters said that they'll cheer for Freeman. Only 15% said they will boo him, and then 21% said they'll boo Marcell Ozuna instead. Remember, Ozuna had that domestic abuse case, and I thought Major League Baseball went really soft on him. They preemptively, or they retroactively suspended him for the time he missed last year. They gave him a 20-game suspension. Oh, he missed 20 games last year? All right, you're good then. That'd be like if the NFL said, Deshaun's going to be suspended for a year. Oh, you didn't play all last year? Okay, you're good. You could go play week one. I thought that was pretty weak of the Major League Baseball. So I can understand if Braves fans have an issue with Ozuna still being on the team after getting into an incident with his wife last year. But I'm actually kind of surprised. 64% said they'll cheer for Freeman. 15% said they'll boo him. That's probably the reason, right? You probably should cheer for him. I did not like, now I'm not a Braves fan, but I did not like how things went down this offseason. And I thought he was being a little greedy. You know, I thought both sides could have handled it better. Maybe it was more about Freddie's agent than it was Freddie himself. But remember, Tom Glavin left the Braves. Now, he did leave them to go to the Mets. And when he came back, Tom Glavin got booed. Now, the Mets are a rival, but I would also argue in recent years the Dodgers have been more of a rival than Atlanta because of the playoff series than the Mets, who really haven't been much of a threat until this year. So even Tom Glavin, who spent 16 years with the Braves and was a Hall of Fame pitcher, he got booed in his return. Will Freeman get booed tonight? I think there'll be some boos, and I'll be honest, wouldn't fault you if you're a Braves fan who booed him. I thought Freeman was a little too greedy this offseason. Should have finished his career in Atlanta. Hour two coming up next.